There's some crazy stuff out there, some crazy criticism. A lot of it anti-Jewish. We'll confront it today, right here.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
On the way up to the studio today, I was listening to the scriptures, listening to the book of Deuteronomy, and the laws about bloodshed and the degree to which God took this seriously and wanted Israel to take it seriously, saying that bloodshed pollutes the land, and therefore it had to be dealt with decisively. All the more was I struck in light of yet another mass shooting here in America, this time in a bar in Southern California, with an Army veteran apparently had been suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. In any case, more horrible news, more bloodshed, and we're so used to it. But it does defile, it does pollute, it does even more than destroy the lives of those directly affected. Another reason to pray for mercy on our land and for grace on the families of the victims, that there be turning to God and hope in the midst of the pain and the tragedy. This is Michael Brown, and it is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on The Real Messiah. Well, gosh, on Wednesday nights, we do an outreach show called Real Messiah through New York City and live online as well. You may have watched it. We talked about the irrationality of anti-Semitism last night, among other things. And sometimes I make the mistake of calling it The Line of Fire, because that's what I've done every day for 10 plus years. And, well, I did the reverse now, because it's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. I brought the title of last night's broadcast into today's. But this is The Line of Fire. Yeah, same person, same host, in case the voice sounds familiar. And we take your Jewish-related calls. 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call. So we take your Jewish-related calls here on Thursdays and a lot of other things to talk about. I was just in Canada, less than 2 weeks ago, and, well, last weekend, actually. And I happened to mention to the folks there that I really appreciated their former Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, who is a conservative and a very strong friend of Israel. I understand he's doing some excellent work for Israel now, that he's not the prime minister. And I said, I much preferred him to your new prime minister, Justin Trudeau. Got a lot of smiles from the folks there. Of course, Justin Trudeau is liberal activist in many ways, pro-LGBT activism, pushing back against other things that we would say are important as followers of Jesus. But to his credit, he issued a public apology. I just saw the headline earlier today. He issued a public apology to Jewish citizens of Canada because there was a boat called the St. Louis. This is one of the most heartrending stories of the Holocaust. Jewish refugees escaped Europe, got on this boat, and America would not take in the St. Louis, and Canada would not take in the St. Louis. You say, why? The great question, the great, profound, ugly, horrific question. Here, Jewish refugees fleeing from Hitler's Germany and Hitler's Europe, and they make it to our shores and to Canada's shores, and they're not welcomed. They're not welcome. So today, Trudeau, or it's posted today, he apologized for Canada's turning away the ship. You say, what happened to them? Ultimately, they had to go back to Europe, and most of them died. Most of them were slaughtered by the Nazis. He also said, that they've got to do a better job in Canada against some things like the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Here, reading from an article in the New York Times about this, the United States also refused the captain's desperate pleas for asylum, as did Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Panama. In the end, the boat returned to Europe, but not to Germany. Jewish organizations secured them visas to Britain, the Netherlands, Belgium, and France, but as Germany expanded its territory, some 254 were captured and killed in Nazi death camps. Trudeau said, We refused to help them when we could have. We contributed to sealing the cruel fates of far too many places like Auschwitz, Treblinka, and Belzec. We failed them, and for that we are sorry. Now, Prime Minister Trudeau has apologized about a number of things in his tenure, but it's striking that this is still an issue he feels to bring up all these decades later. A story that many Americans are not familiar with, many Canadians not familiar with. Hopefully, this will bring the harsh realities up to the surface. When we talk about anti-Semitism, it is quite literally deadly. Deadly. Now, against that backdrop, and before we go to your calls, let me share with you some things that I found posted on our social media pages, on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, not just general statements that are out there attacking the Jewish people or attacking me, but stuff that happened to be posted on our own sites. Some of them were removed because they were libelous or just filled with falsehoods and ugly statements. Otherwise, we welcome disagreement and dissent. That's fine. But I just want you to get a feel of some of the stuff that's out there. In light of Prime Minister Trudeau apologizing, I just want you to get a feel. So here's one that was posted in response to the video where I talked about Todd Friel and Phil Johnson branding me dangerous, Dr. Brown. Of course, I took that as a compliment, dangerous to the kingdom of darkness, dangerous to the devil's work. But here's what someone posted. Dr. Brown is an ignorant fool and Zionist apologist. The man will defend the devil himself if it helped Israel. So, I smile because it's so pathetic what people post, and you have to feel bad for them, although it's grievous that people hold to these views. Doesn't hurt me, affect me, but I feel bad for the people. But what's so interesting is because I say God is faithful. God is faithful. He keeps his promises. It's not about Israel's superiority or Israel's goodness. I said at a Jewish conference, a Messianic Jewish conference in Toronto, with many lovers of Israel there, I said Israel is in the land today, not because of Israel's goodness, but because of God's goodness. Israel is in the land today, not because of our faithfulness, but because of God's faithfulness. I've said that over and over and over. And I've often spoke about the need for repentance in Israel and the need for transformation of lives in Israel. And I've called Israel to account if I felt Israel didn't act righteously as a friend and supporter of Israel and as a Jew myself. But because I say God keeps his promises, that makes me an ignorant fool, a Zionist apologist who will defend the devil himself if it helped Israel. You know, people have these sore spots, these blind spots. And when a little light of truth gets in them, it produces these crazy reactions. Okay, how about this one, all right? And this was a series of posts from one individual, and he was responding to my loving challenge to Palestinian Christians that I delivered in Beit Jala next to Bethlehem in May this year at the Christ at the Checkpoint conference as the only pro-Israel voice at the conference. He says this, people destroy their homes, speaking of Israelis destroying Palestinian homes, and kill their families, and you want to tell them what to do. You are a liar. The promises are to Christ. You are a liar. In other words, no promises remain for Israel. Nope. The promises that God gave to Israel and to his seed, which find ultimate fulfillment in Jesus in terms of through him, the whole world is blessed. But the seed is a plural seed over and over and over and over and over and over and over in the scriptures to your descendants, your descendants, your descendants, your descendants, your descendants in the plural. I mean, verse after verse after verse. It becomes monotonous when you start quoting them because it's verse after verse after verse after verse after verse. You say, yeah, God's going to keep his promises. Once he's scattered from the land, he will bring back to them. No, you're a liar. So I'm a liar for quoting scores and scores and scores and scores and scores of verses, which the New Testament itself reinforces. Uh-huh. And then he goes on. He calls me a Zionist shill. So correct me if I'm wrong, but if I was a Zionist shill, that would mean I'm getting paid by Israel to do this, or paid by a Jewish organization to hold these positions, right? As opposed to being a Jewish follower of Jesus who's widely rejected by other Jews because of my faith in Jesus. I'm a Zionist shill. Hey, please locate. If you could do this, it'd be great because we could really use the funds. Please tell us which bank account the money's going into so we could use it for Jewish outreach and ministry and our missions work. Yeah, would you do that? That'd be awesome. This gentleman, Brian, who's got these posts, that would be terrific if you could find where the Zionists are depositing the money so we can access it and use it for the gospel. And then he says, it's because of Zionists like you that Christians don't even know about the Palestine conflict. Actually, we talk about it frequently. And we posted a debate that I did with Reverend Munter Isaac, or Isaac, who is the leader of the Christ at the Checkpoint Conference. And we frequently talk about these issues, and I've had Palestinian guests on my radio show to talk about them. Mm-hmm. Oh, and then he, just to show you the level of spiritual blindness, and I'm doing this to illustrate a point. I get this day and night. We get this junk posted by the hour on our different social media pages. And ones that I spot, I'll just put into a file. Just, well, it's encouraging to know you're doing the right thing. But he adds, you are a false prophet. Those who deny Christ will not be saved. Yeah. That's why we bring the gospel to the Jewish people, Muslim people, Hindu people, atheists, nominal Christians, because those who deny Jesus the Messiah will not be saved. Yeah, that's why I've been branded public enemy number one by some rabbis over the years, because of our Jewish outreach, because of our telling our people, you need Jesus. So people get so blinded, they hear in such twisted, bizarre ways that they're unable to think clearly. And friends, I always challenge myself with this. I challenge you too. Look for blind spots. You say, well, I don't know if I have a blind spot. Exactly. So when you're driving, right, there's a blind spot over you. You look in your rearview mirror, right? But before you switch lanes, you turn your head. Why do you turn your head? Because you have a blind spot there. It looks okay through the rear view, the side view mirror, right? You look at rear view, side view, but then you look back because you know there's a blind spot. So over the years, with the help of my wife Nancy, with the help of other friends, with the help of time alone before God, I've learned what more of my blind spots are. So I know to turn, to compensate, to look again, lest I mishear, misunderstand. It's a healthy thing. God, show us our blind spots. If the folks posting here had done this, they'd do a lot less posting and a lot more listening. All right, we'll be right back. Your calls are next. God of light,
hear our cry. Send the fire. It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday here on the Line of Fire. Michael Brown, blessed to be with you. Hey, 1 week from tonight, God willing, I'll be debating Michael Sullivan. He is a preterist author and teacher, and he's challenged me for some time to look at 1 Corinthians 13 and say, yes, tongues will cease when Jesus returns, when the end comes, but the end came in the year 70 when the temple was destroyed. I personally find it to be an utterly unscriptural position. He's very zealous about it, written about it, passionate about it. So I agreed to do the debate. That is scheduled for 1 week from tonight. If you live in the greater Charlotte, North Carolina area, it will be taking place at Fire Church. So this is November 15th, 1 week from tonight, 7 p.m. Did tongues, prophecy, and knowledge cease in 70 A.D. The obvious answer, no. The Bible says the contrary, and history says the contrary. But we'll open this up together, and you're welcome to come. Free admission. So again, this will be a Fire Church, and we hope to do a live stream of the event as well. Those that can't get there will be able to watch that, and then post a video subsequently or have it available on DVD. And it does tie in with Israel and promises to Israel as well, and we'll get into that. But definitely does tie in as well. All right, let's start in Florida, 866-34-TRUTH. Catherine, you're on the line of fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I wanted to ask you if you had heard of Nehemiah Gordon, who is a Karaite Jew. He wrote the Hebrew Yeshua versus the Greek Jesus, and just getting the Hebrew perspective on who Jesus was. And he says the Gospel of Matthew and maybe some other New Testament books were originally written in Hebrew. And I wondered if you'd heard of him and had an opinion on that position.
Yeah, I've addressed it many a time, so thanks for asking. I have a lengthy scholarly article dismantling some of what was called the Jerusalem School. We had some terrific scholars, the Jerusalem School for Synoptic Gospels, but there was a popular book written by Roy Blizzard and David Biven called Understanding the Difficult Words of Jesus that was basically saying you can't really understand the New Testament unless you translate it back from Greek into Hebrew, etc. And although there are a lot of great points in the book, a lot of it was dangerous, bogus, just creating verses out of nothing to say, well, this is what it is in Greek, but if you put it back in Hebrew, it would mean this. A very, very dangerous practice to try to take something from one language and put it back into an alleged original. In fact, and I'll get you about Nehemiah Gordon's work in a moment. In fact, we knew there's a book that's in the Catholic canon in the Septuagint called Ecclesiasticus or Ben Sira. Uh-huh. And we know by the introduction to the book that it was originally written in Hebrew, but we have it in Greek translation. So one Jewish scholar, 100 years ago or so, he took the Greek and he reconstructed it and put it back in what he felt was the original Hebrew, right? Well, then some decades ago, the original Hebrew for that document was discovered. And so we could now compare it to his putting the Greek back into the Hebrew. In other words, did he reconstruct the original accurately? He didn't get a single verse right. Not a single verse.
Wow.
So this whole idea that, when Matthew says, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness, well, he didn't really mean that. It's blessed are those who pursue peace or something like that. That's a really dangerous practice because we're taking what God preserved for us, which is thousands of manuscripts of the ancient Greek New Testament, parts of books, whole books, single sections. We're saying that what God preserved for us is not good enough. What we need to do is reconstruct based on what? We don't have an original. Okay, so what about the idea that Matthew was originally written in Hebrew? Well, that's not Nehemiah Gordon's idea. He didn't come up with that. And he's a serious student of the Hebrew language. He's worked on the Dead Sea Scrolls. He may have popular material out there, but he's a serious student of the Hebrew. But there are a couple of traditions recorded in the early church that state that Matthew originally took the sayings of Jesus and passed them on in Hebrew. Some think it may have meant Aramaic, but let's just say it meant Hebrew, all right? And then we have a couple of the early church leaders referencing seeing some of these documents, whether it was the letter to the Hebrews or Matthew, in an original Hebrew. And then you have a reference in the Talmud that speaks of gospel writings in Hebrew. The bottom line is, if they existed, we don't have any of them. We don't have them. There's not a single ancient manuscript. When people say, well, we've translated the New Testament based on the original Hebrew, we don't have an original Hebrew. No such documents exist. There are just a few references to them, but there's no living human being who has ever seen them, nor have they been attested to that anyone saw them for probably over 1,500 years. And if there was a compilation of the words of Jesus in Hebrew or Aramaic that Matthew put together, no one says that's the Gospel of Matthew itself. In other words, that could have just been a compilation of the sayings of the Lord. And what Matthew scholars, Greek scholars, have said to me is that Matthew does not have the feel of a translation. It has the feel of something written originally in Greek. So what about the whole argument that Nehemiah Gordon is giving, that this medieval Hebrew manuscript actually is an original, that it has a lot of it that passes on what the original Hebrew Matthew would have said? Very, 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 very few scholars take that claim seriously. And the fact that he can point out, hey, look, what's the normal argument? Why did rabbis, Jewish leaders, have copies of the New Testament in Hebrew? Because they translated into Hebrew so they could study it to refute the missionaries, all right? So he would say, well, if that's the case, why does this have like plays on words that you would not
right,
do
that's
if you
what
were...
he always says.
Right, right. But that's a fair question. We don't necessarily have an answer for it. In other words, I'm not going to try to come up with an answer and force something. But what we do know is that there is no ancient Hebrew manuscript of Matthew or of the New Testament books. Zero. None that exist. God has providentially preserved for us the New Testament in Greek. All of the early quotations from all of the early church leaders reflect the Greek or those writing in Latin, the Latin. The ancient Aramaic translation called the Peshitta does not contain the variants or the changes that Nehemiah Gordon points to, like in Matthew 23, for example. He has an argument there as to what the original Hebrew was. So these just seem to be expansions. It could also be, there's another possibility, that the plays on words and the niceties of the translations, that those were due to Hebrew writing or Hebrew-speaking Christians, who followers of Jesus, who made nice translations that the rabbis then used. That's another possibility. But what has been preserved for us is the Greek New Testament. And if we ever find ancient Hebrew or Aramaic manuscripts that predate those, then we incorporate that into the evidence. So I find a book like that to be very interesting, with lots of helpful insights about the Jewishness of Jesus, but absolutely making unsubstantiated claims that the vast majority of scholars don't take seriously.
That makes sense. Now, he would say that Shamtov's Hebrew Matthew from the 1200s is what we have that was, you know, never translated and it's just been copied. Would you consider that to be worth anything if it's, you know, from the 1200s and we have, you know, earlier manuscripts from the 400s, you know?
No, the fact is, the only evidence we have is that it's a later composition, that somebody translated it from Greek into Hebrew. That's the only thing we know. There is no evidence that it was passing down an original Hebrew from generation after generation after generation. That's why scholars have known about the Shem Tov manuscript. They've known about it, but it's no big deal. And it was, okay, great. We know, just like you have Arabic translations, you have Aramaic translations, you have Ethiopic translations, you have all kinds of translations, many of them being very ancient. But again, you have to ask yourself, why is it that the Latin translations don't reflect these variants? Why is it that the Aramaic translations, Aramaic being very close to Hebrew, they don't reflect these variants at all? So where that manuscript differs from the Greek New Testament, you reject those readings. You say, oh, that's curious, that's interesting, wonder where that came from, but they have to be put aside and rejected. Is it possible that they reflect some earlier tradition? It's possible, but there's no evidence for it. And until we have evidence for it, what God has preserved is what we have to look at and go by. All right, thank you for the call and appreciate your ability to interact with the points I make. So we were following each other and tracking. Great. 866-34-TRUTH. Some great questions waiting for me here, and we'll get to them on the other side of the break. And then I want to share more of the craziness that's out there, more of the crazy attacks and the bizarre things people hold to. You know, for telling the truth about the Paleo-Hebrew script, the ancient Hebrew script, which was shared by and really originated from what we can tell by the Phoenicians, for telling the truth about that, that there are no secret pictographic meanings in there, that by the time this became an alphabetic script, it was just an alphabet, that you have no idea the vitriol. You're a liar. You're full of the devil. You don't know the Holy Spirit. And I think these poor people, all I'm doing is telling them the truth that any linguistic scholar on the planet would say, yeah, who doesn't know that? Any scholar of the Hebrew language would say, yeah, who doesn't know that? Of course, we all know that. But just for telling the truth because it rains on somebody's fantasy parade, boy, that's so sad. It's so sad that people often love their pet doctrines more than they love the truth. And it's the truth that sets us free. Bring it on, even when it hurts. Bring it on. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. All right, a whole lot more to come your way today on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on the Line of Fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, welcome to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast on The Line of Fire. Yeah, I knew the music was coming, but was poised to talk anyway. So what's it like being a Jewish follower of Jesus? What type of stuff do you get hit with, confronted with? Well, here's a comment that was posted in part of my interaction on YouTube with Rabbi Yisrael Blumenthal, counter-missionary rabbi. And this is from a fellow named Yoshi Ben. Deceived Jew. So sad that the Catholics got to you. Come back home and leave idolatry. You know, again, it's that spirit of falsehood that disqualifies itself. Oh, the Catholics got to me. Interesting. So the church where I came to faith, Italian Pentecostal, which was as anti-Catholic as you could get, most of the people in that church had left Catholicism. That was their background. They were Catholic, and then they joined that church. And there was a debate in that church as to whether a Catholic could even be a Christian. Ah, so the Catholics got to me. Uh-huh. Well, that would confirm something I talked about on the Real Messiah broadcast, or Jewish outreach broadcast in New York City last night, that the Jesuits are all crypto-Jews. And that all popes are also Jews. I guess the Catholics got to, no, or the Jews got to the Catholics. Which is it? Yeah. And then idolatry. Yeah, this is how they'd see it. They would think I worship a man as opposed to worship one God and one God only, revealed himself to us most fully through his son, Jesus the Messiah. I worship one God and don't share my affection, love for God with anyone else but him. So when I worship the Son of God, I am worshiping God, Father, Son, Spirit, one God. Anyway, this is, how about this one? This was somebody responding to a video where I was talking about Palestinians. This is from a fellow named Gerald. The Dr. Brown is one-sided. So I'm not Dr. Brown, but the Dr. Brown. I guess that's nice. He's a fake Jew, just like those of Israel. So the Catholics got to me. I'm a fake Jew. Ask the Palestinian Christians how they feel about the Zionist. I am telling this guy only represents the Jews' side of the story. There's not a Palestinian in Israel that hasn't seen their loved ones murdered by IDF coward soldiers. So, of course, the Israelis, whose lives are threatened every day by terrorists, to the point that they have to have all their young people serve in the military and spend a disproportionate amount of their money on security. The coward soldiers, got it, who study ethics when they start serving in the IDF and are taught to avoid civilian casualties at all costs, that there's not a single Palestinian in Israel who hasn't seen their loved ones killed, murdered by IDF coward soldiers. This is what people believe. This is what they believe. And whenever I talk about this, I say, of course, Israel does things wrong. And when they do, when we're aware of it, we address it. Yeah, absolutely. But this is typical of the craziness that we get hit with that's out there. 866-34-TRUTH, and in that we rejoice. We don't rejoice that people are in error or people are deceived. We rejoice because God is good, God is true, and he told us we'd have opposition. And when there is genuine disagreement and discussion, let's have it. It will only sharpen us. All right, 866-34-TRUTH to the phones. We go to Lynchburg, Virginia. Michael, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. My question is, does Galatians 3 and 4 prove that the church has replaced Israel? And I was wondering if you could particularly interpret verse 29.
Of Galatians 3, 329?
Of Galatians 3, yes, yes, sir.
Got it, sure. So, no, of course it doesn't prove those things. The New Testament doesn't prove what is false and is mistaken and is wrong theology. However, it does, it has been used quite wrongly, beginning with Galatians 3:16, where Paul makes the point and says that when God said to Abraham, through your offspring, all right, The promise was spoken to Abraham is to his seed, but let's translate it offspring, which would better convey it. Scripture does not say, and to offsprings, meaning many people, but and to your offspring, meaning one person, who is Messiah. So the idea that Paul was saying that the promises that God gave to Israel no longer apply to Israel, verse 17, by the way, refutes that directly, that they only apply to Jesus, that's a horrific misinterpretation of his words and would presuppose that Paul did not know Greek or Hebrew, that he didn't know that the Greek word zera and the Hebrew word zera and the Greek word sperma are normally used collectively. That's why I use the word offspring to convey that. We don't use the word offsprings plural. He fully knew that. What he was doing was kind of a hyper-rabbinic reading to say that there's one particular seed who brings the promises to fulfillment through whom the whole world is blessed. But then you have Zerah over and over and over and over and over and over and over in the New Testament, the Old Testament, referring to the people as the whole, the people as the whole, the people as the whole, the nation, plural, 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 endlessly. I have an in-depth academic article coming out in a future volume refuting replacement theology that deals with Galatians 3:16. The idea that Paul, with one stroke of his pen, could overturn hundreds of verses in the Hebrew Bible and the plain sense of Scripture is something that would cause him to turn over in his grave. That's the first thing. This verse 17 reiterates that the law, which comes 430 years afterwards, cannot annul the promise that was given. And that promise is the land to the plural seed in perpetuity. Then at the end of the chapter, Paul demonstrates that he fully understands that seed is used in a collective sense because he says, if you belong to Messiah, then you are Abraham's seed, heirs according to the promise. So as Paul argues elsewhere, that Abraham is the father of all those who believe. He has a spiritual seed. He has a natural seed. He's the father of the circumcised, the father of the uncircumcised in faith. So the idea that that somehow comes up with a doctrine that Paul would have been shocked to hear, that the promises that God once gave to Israel are now given to the church, not a stitch of the text that supports that. Then in the fourth chapter, he gives a homiletical interpretation of things to come up with a point he wants to make. Which, and again, in keeping with rabbinic thought or early Jewish thought of that time, he makes the point that those who are born of the Spirit persecute the one born of the flesh persecutes the one born of the Spirit. But elsewhere, in, for example, Romans 4, Paul makes plain that he understands the seed is plural, referring to Abraham's natural descendants. And in Romans 15, he says that the Messiah confirms the covenantal promises given to the patriarchs, doesn't cancel them. He confirms them. So Galatians 3 and 4 have been misused to argue a point, but in no way do they teach replacement theology. That would be abhorrent to the entire New Testament. Have you heard them used like that recently and got you wondering?
Yes, sir. So I watched a debate with you and I think Munther Isaac on YouTube, and he used that argument. So I didn't quite hear you answer it in the debate, so I just wanted to get further analysis on it.
Well, listen again, because I answered it head on. I said that it's impossible. If Paul meant that, then he didn't understand Hebrew and he didn't understand Greek. He was one of the most ignorant human beings ever on the planet, and it doesn't even work in English.
I absolutely, I agree with you 100%.
No, no, I'm saying I did address it head on.
So, oh, yes, you did. Absolutely. Okay.
Got it. What's your own view on
Thank
the subject?
Thank you so much.
Yeah, what's your own view?
So I lean more towards dispensational theology, but I'm not replacement at all. I think that God still has promises left for Israel and that they will be regathered in the future. And I'm a futurist, so as far
Got
as eschatology goes.
Yeah, and you know what I appreciate about Reverend, I kept calling him Isaac, it's actually Isaac in Arabic, is it to him, it's all about Jesus. It's all about Jesus. It's all about Jesus. And I appreciate that. But Jesus confirms, the Messiah confirms the promises. He doesn't cancel them. He confirms them. So are Jewish people saved outside of Jesus? No. Do Jewish people need to put their faith in him to be in right relationship with God? Yes. Does God continue to deal with Israel as a people? Yes, because he made promises and he keeps his promises. This should encourage Christians because believers in Jesus often fall short, but God never falls short. So just like Israel's been preserved by grace, we too have been preserved by grace. Hey, Michael, thank you for the call. Very much appreciate it. 866-34-TRUTH. All right, we go to Barrhead, Alberta, Canada. Back to our friend Jonathan. Welcome back to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown. Concerning replacement theology, I'm totally with you. I hate it, and I think it's demonic and destructive. But when I'm often discussing replacement theology with other people, and they often use the terms, oh, no, we're spiritual Israel, they keep using that word, spiritual Israel. And in Romans 11, concerning the olive tree that Gentiles get grafted into, from my point of view, I do see the olive tree as the righteous Jews. And if that's right, then I can kind of see their point of saying that we're part of our kind of spiritual Israel. And I just wanted to hear your view on who the olive tree is in Romans 11.
Yeah, so Jonathan, first, I've met many lovers of Israel and lovers of the Jewish people who consider themselves spiritual Jews based on the end of Romans 2. Or consider themselves to be spiritual Israel. And they, what they're saying is, we share the same heart. God has circumcised our hearts. But they've said it as lovers of Israel, lovers of the Jewish people, as people who don't hold to replacement theology at all. So when they say that, I don't rebuke them. I don't correct them. In fact, I appreciate that. I appreciate the solidarity and the heart. And in fact, many of the promises that God gave to Israel in the Old Testament now are applied to believers spiritually in the New Testament. And Paul can even speak of believers in Philippians 3 as being the circumcision, meaning the ones who are really circumcised in heart and not just those who are circumcised in flesh. That being said, there's not one reference to the term spiritual Israel in the New Testament. The Israel of God that Paul references in Galatians 6:16 most certainly refers to Jewish believers as opposed to the church as a whole. And if you look up every single reference to Israel or Jews in the New Testament, just a few hundred between them, you'll find overwhelmingly over and over and over and over and over, they're talking about the people, the physical people, the actual people. So the olive tree in Romans 11, who is that? We'll answer that on the other side of the break. Stay tuned.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday here on the Line of Fire. So, Jonathan, back to your question, who is the olive tree? What is the olive tree in Romans 11? So we see in Romans 11, beginning in the middle of the chapter, that Paul makes reference to this tree, likens the Gentiles to wild olive branches that were broken off and grafted in to an olive tree, and likens the Israelites to the natural branches, and those that didn't believe in the Messiah got cut off. So since the it's speaking of the branches being individuals, right? Individuals. And the individuals drink of the nourishing sap of the olive tree, Jewish believers and Gentile believers. Is the tree itself Israel? Well, we know that Israel is called a vine in the Hebrew Bible, and Jesus in John 15 refers to him as the true vine, and hence the one who fulfills God's purposes for Israel. But is Israel generally likened to an olive tree as a whole? That could be debated. Those images are used, but that could be debated. So it's possible that it's speaking of Israel as a whole on a national level. Again, the individual branch is speaking of individuals within Israel. But some would argue that the olive tree is the Messiah, that it's the same image that you have in John 15 of the vine with branches. and the branches that don't bear fruit are cut off and thrown in the fire. Here, the branches that don't believe are cut off. So it could well be that the olive tree is the Messiah, not the nation of Israel, but the Messiah. And again, realize that we drink of him. We feed on him. Our life comes from him. The branch bears fruit by being connected to the vine. So it could well be that. You know, some believe it's the patriarchs, and that's the ultimate, the root of all of this. But do we drink the nourishing sap from them? So you could make a good argument that the olive tree is the Messiah, and that originally it had Israelite branches. Those are the natural branches, Messiah's own people. And then individuals broken off because of unbelief. The promise to the nation remains, but individuals that don't believe broken off. And now Gentiles grafted in, so we're all part of the same spiritual family in Jesus. But Paul makes clear in 1 Corinthians 7, if a Jew gets saved, don't become a Gentile. If a Gentile gets saved, don't become a Jew, because we each have our own distinct calling. Let me share one more quote with you to give you an idea of some of the deception that's out there, all right? And I'm not mad at the people who post this. Again, I feel bad for them. So this is after my presentation. This was after my presentation, my loving challenge to my Palestinian Christian friends, all right? This was after the presentation. This is how the fellow responds. Dr. Brown needed an apostle Paul to openly rebuke him. Brown openly promoted the wholesale snubbing of the Gentile Christians in Palestine because he is butting up to the Pharisees in Israel who reject Jesus Christ. Are you talking about somebody being blind? Deceived? Wow. Yeah. So not only was there no snubbing of Gentile Christians, what people most appreciated was the love that I had for the Palestinian Christians, which I heard from one after another, to the point I almost broke down in tears saying, look, this is going to be very difficult to speak because I know some of what I say is going to hurt you. And that pains me. And I got hugs and a lot of good interaction and fellowship with the people with whom we had open disagreement. And we realized, okay, we become friends in the midst of this, all right? But so I'm butting up to the Pharisees in Israel who reject Jesus Christ. And Matt, see if you could put up the video that we have on our digital library of religious Jews in Israel cursing and saying, we don't believe in Yeshu, which is their way of saying Yeshua. We don't believe in him. Angry Jews shouted, we don't believe in Yeshu, Jesus, as I explain what I believe. You can watch that on our digital library. Again, go to askdrbrown.org, click on search, and just look for angry Jews. My heart goes out to these men. The Jesus that they know is very different than the Jesus of Scripture and true history. And what they know of someone like me is I'm an arch apostate trying to mislead others as well. So when he says, I'm butting up to the Pharisees in Israel, reject Jesus Christ, this would be the people that this person would call the Pharisees. But it gets worse. This guy says this then, the way he turned around and just walked off the stage, like he could not abide the lowly goy anymore while the people he had just eviscerated were showing him respect by clapping for him. This shows his pride in his flesh and glorying in his fathers who killed the prophets and Jesus Christ. I mean, the individual that posted this needs prayer to be under that level of deception. And what's interesting is that we were given very strict time limits, very strict. And because I'm a radio guy, I'm used to strict time limits. Because I do debates, I'm used to strict time limits. So I honor them to the second and to the minute. To stand up there, while everyone clapped after my message, and I eviscerated no one, by the way, but to stand, except for radical Muslim resistance to the gospel. But the idea, if you get to the end of the message, if I stood up there at the end, and as they clapped, it's like, raised my hands, like, yes, yes, that was me, great message. That would be pride. I mean, you got to laugh at people being, I feel bad for people who are that blind. But you got to laugh at it, think, what world do you live in? So I absolutely abided by the time limits, even though I actually thought that I was given a couple of minutes, I was shortened a couple of minutes on what I was supposed to have. The moment I saw where the clock was, I finished and got out of the way immediately to make room for the guy that was going to come up and rebut me. You know, you say, well, how can you smile through this? Well, yeah, you feel bad for the deception of people who post things like that. But you have to smile when you realize how messed up the opposition to truth can be. And it encourages you to stay with the truth and to stay on the path of truth. All right, let's see. We've got time for another call or two. Let's go to Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Chuck, thanks for holding. Welcome to the Line of Fire. Are you there? I guess I thanked you for holding, and you weren't there. Let's go to James in Scottsboro, Alabama. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
How do you do?
Hey, go for it, sir.
Hey, I appreciate you taking my call. I heard you mentioning about the Roman Catholics earlier, that someone had accused you of being deceived by the Catholics.
Yeah, the Catholics got to me because I believe in Jesus. Therefore, the Catholics got to me.
I find that very interesting. I've been doing a study to teach a class on Bible translations, and I was unaware of the horrendous relationship between the Roman Catholic Church and the Protestants. I was actually wondering if you could do a quick elaboration on the Roman Catholic Church relationship with Judaism.
Yeah, so that's very interesting, James. On the one hand, there has been persecution of the Jewish people, demeaning of the Jewish people, demonizing of the Jewish people at the hands of various Catholic leaders, and the Crusaders did turn on Jews in their own communities and order them to be baptized or die. And the Crusader armies in Jerusalem, according to some reports, did burn Jews alive in the great synagogue where they had taken refuge. And it has been pointed out by the historian, the Holocaust historian Raoul Hilberg, that there's nothing the Nazis did except for extermination that the Catholic Church had not done earlier. Having Jews wear a yellow star, confining them to ghettos, depriving them of certain jobs, etc. On the flip side, you do have popes over the centuries that sought to protect Jews. You do have laws that were passed by popes and other Catholic leaders against persecution of Jews. And Martin Luther himself wrote some of the most horrific anti-Semitic things that have ever been written, anti-Judaism and anti-Jew, that although Lutherans repudiated those and ignored them over the centuries, the Nazis found them and utilized his writings again. So there has been anti-Semitism in church history on the Catholic side and the Protestant side. But for sure, because the Catholic Church had so much control, you know, it was like its own empire for periods of time. Yes, there has been a good amount of anti-Semitism in Catholic history as well. And it could be fleshed out. In other words, you could actually implement it because Catholicism ruled whole lands. And as I said, was in a way an empire, its own army and things like that, vast finances. There's a book by a Catholic scholar named Edward Flannery called The Anguish of the Jews. The Anguish of the Jews by Edward Flannery, a Catholic scholar. All right. You can get his perspective as an insider, a respected Catholic scholar as well. Hey, friends, have you seen our newest Consider This video? We are getting rave reports from the viewers. We answer the question, why don't more pastors speak out in moral and cultural issues? And you know who I'm hearing from? I'm hearing from pastors who are saying, thank you. Thank you for this video. I got some great notes just in the last 24 hours. The video was just posted yesterday. And I'm looking at our YouTube channel. So far, it's likes versus dislikes, 202-3. You know what that means? It means that a lot of congregants are saying, pastor, speak out. Equip us. Help us. These are the issues we deal with. Where do you find the video? Well, on our YouTube channel, of course, Ask Dr. Brown, or right on our homepage, askdrbrown.org/consider this. And if these videos, this radio broadcast, if this is a blessing to you, stand with us. We could really use your help today. Go to askdrbrown.org and click donate. Thanks.